Good evening. This is Mae Brussel. The title of this broadcast is World Watchers International, 1 hour discussion of various news events. The number of the program is 742, February the 24th, 1986. Last week I was talking about some matters that all seem to converge together. Ronald Reagan's speech on to the State of the Nation, his concern with the budget, with the Star Wars, the AIDS, the disaster of the Challenger, the shuttle Challenger exploding, and some of the links of space to exploratory work on AIDS and also to advanced genetic sciences out here in California, an international combine, and the way events are developing, I am sure that AIDS is a very big, important project for the military. Now, in the book Alternative 3 that I've mentioned many times, there's a plan for removing 70 to 80% of the population on the Earth because they're polluting it. They have no purpose, so to speak. They're just what Reagan, the powers that be, or Hitler called the useless eaters, or the people that just have to be taken care of. It was a plan for genocide that included NASA at the time that this book was written, or from the very beginning of NASA, and an expose or a attempt to understand some of these processes by an English researcher by the name of Leslie Watkins. I mentioned that book to a friend who was over last night, and she said, well, why would they need to do all of that if they had things like diseases and plagues to wipe out large amounts of population, and it's much cheaper? So that the alternate way of eliminating people, blacks, gays, Mexican-Americans, and so forth, is easier to do through disease, and that always was a way that Hitler considered eliminating various people, separating them, and getting rid of a large hunk of the deformed and so forth, and then isolating and experimenting on healthy and being very consumed with medicine. So that as events shape up, it cited for you just last week an article from the San Francisco Examiner that has to do with the Hoover Institute, with Stanford Research, with organizations out here in California that are linked to the military, and it reminds me of that nurturing season when Reagan was governor here with the Office of Emergency Service, with Edwin Meese, with the Garden Plot, and these sinister things that hatched out here with these same people in California. So I want to continue with that article and other items that I gave the outline for last week. And also, before I do that, share with you some of the news stories on the space shuttle. It is getting a lot of coverage, and I'm sure that most of you are keeping up with it, you very careful world watchers, so I don't have to go into the details of all the news, but there are six or seven items that are really important in understanding the way they're rearranging this information, trying to cover up how it's oozing out. One was an article in the Washington Post, February the 9th, Forces Go Awry, A-W-R-Y, I never liked that word anyway, and form an accident chain, shuttle technology pitted against human error, weather, or politics. Now, the point about that story is that the technology that is pitted against those other factors was such that they were never supposed to go off in rigid in frigid weather, rather frigid, get those two intertwined, the rigid and the frigid. Well, it was a rigid rule not to go off in freezing weather, don't blast. The technology was not made, this particular technology, for that kind of weather. The error that they refer to, human error, was the error of ignoring instructions that were going on, as you heard this past week, for 8.5 hours all night while those seven astronauts were sleeping or resting. Ignoring the instructions and then taking orders from somebody above, and of course there's a lot of rumors going around in Washington, and you know what I think happened there. The third thing about the weather, this accident chain, that wasn't an accident. It was specified that this is what happens in cold weather. It was always part of the technology, the weather effect on the fuel, on the seams, on the tiles, and on the pipes at the launching pad. And as far as politics, in this particular case, it wasn't the politics of hurrying the shuttle program for somebody's satisfaction. I don't believe that at all. I think it was to use the teacher to cover things like deficits and budget problems, and to give Reagan something upper for his speech to Congress, for the State of the Union speech, as I said before, and also escalating a Star Wars project. The politics was shifting the pressure away, or the activity away from NASA and into the hands of the Defense Intelligence Agency and the Star Wars and the Air Force. Now, Dan Rather on the CBS Evening News, February 18th, that was Tuesday, described the launching and the testimony before the Rogers Commission, investigating it, and began the program by saying the launch in the cold was a political decision. And that was spelled out and said very clearly, which is interesting because whether or not you catch Jupiter isn't a political decision. A political decision implies, I believe, the White House, and he said it in such a way that I think your ears would perk up if you happened to hear it. The next article besides this one about the accident chains was one in the Washington Times, February the 7th. Engineers doubt the cold caused disaster. Now, I cited that about 2 weeks ago when William Rogers began his commission, because I believe that they bring in a man of that kind to cover up the real facts. And as I cited the first day, they said weather wasn't a factor. Well, the newspaper that has it across the whole top of the page in big black letters, of course, is Arnard de Borchgrave, the editor for Reverend Moon's newspaper, The Washington Times. And this article said that Jesse Moore would set up a devil's advocate committee to attempt to find holes in whatever theories the main NASA team produced to suggest other theories. Well, since that was written, Mr. Jesse Moore has been removed from his position, and Mr. Lovingood, who we cited before, had testified before this group and had even said the weather was in the 50s. So it's interesting to see 3 weeks later how the news carried it in the stories of the unimportance of ice. And as I say, the Washington Times is wonderful in writing these kinds of stories. The author of these stories is Christopher Simpson, and I believe it probably is the same Christopher Simpson who is out here at the house and also was with Pete Carey in San Jose when he was doing a story on Otto von Bolschwing and the TCI Corporation. I believe it was for Penthouse, one of those magazines. And he wrote about Otto von Bolschwing, but left out all the Helene von Damm connections to Ronald Reagan and her links to Reinhard Galen and the Galen Organization. It's interesting how Tom Bethel, who worked for Jim Garrison, who turned out to be a spy, then works and publishes in Washington Times. John Reese from Western Goals, who always was an agent provocateur and an instigator of disinformation and problems, similar to Arnard de Borchgrave and his friend Robert Moss. John Reese has had a lot of articles, along with Tom Bethel, in Washington Times, and here I see this by Christopher Simpson. Another early article that came out showed Jesse Moore. This is from the New York Times, February the 7th, and the main thrust of this is that the officials from NASA, the title of the article, are surprised by aggressive questions. Now, there's never been a congressional committee, the Senate Watergate, the Warren Commission, the Korea Gate, that was ever aggressive. And they cited two men who seemed to be the ones who spearheaded, as I said before, to go right to the heart of the matter. One was Albert D. Whelan, W-H-E-E-L-O-N, Senior Vice President of Use Aircraft, who's on this committee, and Richard P. Feynman, F-E-Y-N-M-A-N, a professor from Caltech. NASA thought that they would be treated nicely and that they could get away with all kinds of avoidance of questions and hard questions. And Mr. Lovingood is cited in this article saying the propellant was 55 degrees, but then he said that it wasn't based on an instrument that measures the heat, but they had it, or the cold, it should be up to 55 degrees. Another interesting article this past week is in the San Jose Mercury, February 18th. With large black letters, the temperature readings appear to raise serious questions about the flow of information from ground crews to the launch pad to top NASA officials. And this goes into the fact that the temperature went down as low as 7 degrees, much lower than the 28 or 23 we cited in the past week. Now we're in the 6 and 7s. And this article says, what we don't know is who knew about those temperature readings. And, of course, that was the big question from the very beginning. And the committee acted surprised that this kind of temperature information didn't flow to top NASA officials. Well, that is an outright lie. This kind of information that came out towards the end of this week was to let you think that while some people knew how cold it was, the others didn't know it. They were down there in Florida when the ship launched. They know what cold weather is, and they talked about cold weather on Saturday and Sunday, how Sunday the weather was nice, but it looked like it would be cold on Monday. If it was cold on Tuesday, they'd delay until Thursday. That's why I know that scratching this shuttle or making it go that day had very little to do with catching Jupiter, that they may have to do that work 13 months from now. But that's not the point. If you don't have a ship, you can't do it at all. And they were cautious about the weather right up to the time when they had to go. So I know, again, to look for the story of who made them go. Another long story in the San Jose Mercury. Panel leader appalled that NASA missed the key data. Decision makers at NASA didn't get key launch data. Now, you have to know propaganda and outright lies when you see them. And this is just a bunch of BS that they didn't know when the temperature drops to those points or what the temperature does to the pieces of machinery. That's their job to know. And if they're on the phone all night talking about it and they don't know that it's cold in the morning, they want the underlings to take the pressure. Now, the Senate wanted members of their committee investigating NASA to be able to sit in with William Rogers' committee, the commission appointed by the president, and Mr. Rogers won't let them. It would duplicate information and papers going back and forth if they heard the question asked by Rogers' committee. The senator's aides or senators could hear it and then discuss it between themselves. So there was a part of this one story, and many of you might have seen it. Rogers resisted repeated attempts by members of the Senate Science Subcommittee, which has NASA budget oversight, to allow the senators to sit on the commission's closed session. Senator Donald Regal of Michigan and Hollings pressed the demand, but Rogers, with exasperation, rebuffed them on the grounds of the separation between the president and the Congress and ruled it out. Now, that is why they call it a president's commission. The president's commission to investigate the murder of John Kennedy, the president's commission covered up Lyndon Johnson's role in the murder of John Kennedy, the covering it up or knowing of it in advance, because he appoints the commission and their rule is to keep away from the throne. With the time of the Watergate committee, it was the president's commission. They were investigating Richard Nixon, and it was their role, Senator Sam Ervin and the whole gang, to see that it never went back to Dallas, Texas, to the murder of Kennedy, to the anti-Castro-Cubans that were involved in the murder of Kennedy, and the Bay of Pigs operations, to keep it from the president. And so in the Korea Gate investigation, of course, was just a farce too. But the president's commission is separate from Congress. Even when you have something like a huge space shuttle blowing up that the American people pay for, we send the people to Congress and they decide where the debts or the cash flow. And they said, no, you can't sit on this. We represent the president, not the Congress. Well, that's an old mafia leader from way back with close roots to George Smathers, former senator, and to Bebe Rebozo and Mr. Al Bonap and Richard Nixon and Resorts International. And I just briefly mentioned some of his background. Many of you know it. So that's Mr. Rogers. I represent the president, so Congress can't sit in. Now, the Los Angeles Times had a long story February 15th. White Knight sought for demoralized space agency. They don't know who will run the space agency. They're into so much trouble. Well, White Knight was the code word for Jim Jones. Some people thought he was around and didn't die and then was dumped out of an airplane. They won't find a Jim Jones for a White Knight. And this is part of the fairy tale belief of Ronald Reagan and his mentality that somebody under those terms is going to come along. I imagine maybe he would like to think of Henry Kissinger. He gave them the role for Central America, and maybe with Kissinger's close relationship to Daniel Graham and Fritz Kramer and the Star Wars gang, I wouldn't surprise if they turned all NASA over to Star Wars and let somebody like Henry Kissinger have one more crack at ruining up this country. a subscriber to World Watcher, sent me a article from New Women magazine, February 1986, The Right Stuff, How an Ordinary Teacher, Wife, and Mother Became the First Private Citizen in Space. And, of course, there were marked pages here for me to read. It said in the early stages, when she was being considered as an astronaut, Miss Colliff's diary helped keep her alive. Interesting the way they refer to the diary by virtue of its very simplicity. Keeping a diary seemed like a gutsy move. What's gutsy about a diary? Always is a diary. The Harvey Oswald, Artie Bremer, and Sirhan, and John Hinckley, and what's unusual to make some notes about your experiences. And the disgusting thing is they don't wait until the ship goes up, a space shuttle, and then comes down. And she wasn't the first ordinary person on there at all. That Mr. Walker from the Johnson & Johnson Laboratory in McDonnell Douglas, he was just an ordinary person, a lab worker. What's so unusual? And all this propaganda and media they feed is so much garbage on garbage. And who cares about the diary? But it just shows how they're anxious to get stories out, and they write about her landing before the thing ever took off and blew away. Another article in the Los Angeles Times, Chain of Errors Doomed the Shuttle. And they confuse and have a long list of black kinds of errors. The human errors, the design flaws, the cold weather, all may have led to the tragedy. And this is similar to the very first article I cited about the human error, the weather, and the politics. This leaves out the name politics. But many factors converged about to bring about the disaster. So you can't just blame the weather. You throw the weather in with all, it was just bad judgment, human judgment. They were fighting about whether to launch or not, and they knew they shouldn't launch. And they're diverting away from the fact that this ship, as I say, wasn't made to go in that kind of weather, and they all knew it, and they were watching it very carefully. So they string the weather and the judgment and the human error, of course it was all those things, and get them all mushed together. But if you think carefully, you can figure out exactly what happened and how it's covered up. And the way it's unfolding is really interesting. Now, last week I was talking about Ronald Reagan and AIDS, because AIDS and military with AIDS and AIDS in California and the drastic steps that are being taken are really scary. And I very seldom go into such depths with a particular article, but once in a while I do, because most of it, I don't want you to miss one bit of the meaning of this particular article. And I'm going to continue where I left off last week so that we can share some more of this story. The title was Drastic Measures Disputed in AIDS Study by David Kirp, K-I-R-P, San Francisco Examiner, Sunday, February the 9th. And it has to do with two of the senior Hoover Institution scholars in Palo Alto who do economic and political analysis, who are part of this studies. One is Rita Ricardo Campbell, a leading contender to succeed Margaret Heckler, heaven help us, who's working on these studies of AIDS to show that AIDS is communicated by casual contact, by breathing, by handling doorknobs, and so forth, that even though the scientific community says this isn't true, the military and the Stanford group are going to show that it is true. And as I warned before, when they set their minds to something, they really go into it and set about to get that into your heads as well. The other person working with Rita Ricardo Campbell is Richard Starr, who's a specialist on the Soviet Union, who headed the American delegation, the Mutual Annual and Balanced Force Reduction Talks between 1981 and 82. And out of Stanford Research, SRI, and a group called AIMS, Advanced Investigation Medical Science Group, and the Institute for Cancer Research, who've done classified work for biological and chemical warfare. You can hear the broadcast number 741 to get the back things that I mentioned on that particular broadcast. But continuing with this article and material I didn't have last week, some of the rhetoric of the funding proposal, this article says, wasn't driven out of a literal belief that AIDS will decimate the population, but by a desire to scare the military into funding the research, that they know it won't necessarily be carried, AIDS, that way. But if the military is scared, they'll give us the money. The assertion that AIDS is easily transmitted directly conflicts with repeated statements made by the Center for Disease Control out of Atlanta, Georgia, and the National Institute for Health. But it goes. This article goes on to say that Dr. Francis, former chief of CDC's AIDS Task Force, the very group, Centers for Disease Control, that says AIDS isn't transmitted that way, Dr. Francis, who's currently working with the California Department of Health Services on AIDS, has been identified in this proposal, along with Stanford and SRI and Ames, to the military, for this proposal to the military, as a member of the Scientific Advisory Committee. So he jumps from CDC, where he knows that the way AIDS is transmitted isn't done this way, and goes with the military and Stanford to prove that it could be transmitted in this way. The article says the proposal also stresses the danger of female-to-male transmission of the disease, particularly through contact with servicemen and prostitutes. And then it goes on, the most scientifically interesting aspect of the proposal, other researchers say, is a claim that the Institute for Cancer Research has developed a technique to spot AIDS virus that is faster and more reliable than anything that is used now, any blood test now. And the as yet unproven technique on all service personnel would be a major component of the research proposal to give this test that is not given at other places to every person in the military. One of the most troubling aspects of the research proposal is to call for studies that lead to social isolation of AIDS victims and others considered at risk for the disease. And that's what the title was about, the concern when this article opened up. The article goes on, the behavioral modification research program that is contemplated as part of this project would involve restriction on the access of military personnel to other high-risk groups, that they would be separated from what they considered high-risk groups. And this, of course, is gays, and that is one of the purpose, to separate individuals who are at work away from gays so they don't expose them to the risk. The possibility of quarantine for those who can be shown through testing to have been exposed to AIDS is explored in a memo titled Legal Social Considerations, prepared by a member of the research team. And they say, and I might have mentioned this last week, it continues towards the end of the article, with a pandemic of catastrophic potential, extraordinary steps may be necessary, according to the internal memos of Ames and others working on the project from Stanford, the Hoover Institute, Stanford Research, the Ames, the AIMS, and the other cancer investigative bodies, with a pandemic of catastrophic potential. These steps range from state-mandated registration of individuals with AIDS to the need for and feasibility of quarantine, register them in your states, or quarantine them, and the feasibility and mandatory and overt identification. So you register, you quarantine, and you identify, however loathsome the Starve David concept is. And they refer to it by the Starve David concept, and the article goes on that Mr. Thor of the Institute of Cancer Research said he was uncomfortable with the Starve David image. I don't like inflammatory labels. He works at the Institute for Cancer Research, but Starve David image means identifying Jews the way Adolf Hitler did. He doesn't like it to have a name like the Starve David. The identification of AIDS people isn't bad, but people may get up in arms because they make the parallel between Nazi Germany. So it bothers him that you have this image, but they use it in their literature and go on to say that, well, it's bad, that is what they're calling it, the Starve David image. The military's $40 million AIDS research program received little scrutiny by Congress or the news media since it was hurried through last September at the very end of the budget-making process. And many of you who listen to World Watchers every week know how outraged I was to read that $40 million was going to the military to work on AIDS. And the article concludes, at the time, critics questioned whether the military would do credible AIDS research. And I guess you would classify me among those critics. When the generals lost Divad, a tank scrapped by the Secretary of Defense, as ineffective, they insisted on money for AIDS. "We will give you Divad, you give us money for AIDS," said one congressional source. They had seen in the preliminary figures on AIDS in the military, and they panicked. They were concerned over briefings on AIDS conducted last summer to the Defense Department officials in 1985. There were virologists and infectious disease specialists painting a grim picture of the spread of AIDS to non-high-risk population. One claim was that more servicemen would die from AIDS before Reagan left office than died in Vietnam. That certainly got the attention of the admirals and generals. Defense Department officials working with Senator Ted Stevens of Alaska, a member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, got the $40 million for AIDS research. They tacked it onto a defense budget. None of the money has been spent yet, but a lot of the defense money could go back to Stanford for this project, and these people are linked to chemical and biological warfare. That is very scary. Now, I want to continue with some of the articles that I briefly mentioned in my outline last week pertaining to Ronald Reagan's pitch for his Star Wars, his defense systems, his new Star War airplane, and his concern with AIDS, and give you some more specifics about these various items and how they relate to each other. On broadcast number 657, this was July 9th, 1985, a year and a half ago, I cited an article in the San Francisco Chronicle that came out July the 8th, 1984, just around that same time. Navy considered closing their lab, but new mission found for it. They were going to close their biological chemical warfare lab in the Bay Area, but they decide they could use it for other things. Now, is it being used again for this program that they're going into to use the military and Stanford research for some more testing of cancer and immune systems? The article then said, starting in 1950 through 1970, there's a laboratory in Oakland, California, that was making plague and tularemia and lethal mist to test first on animals and then to test germ warfare on how it spread throughout the San Francisco Bay. And you know that outside of New York City, the largest AIDS population is right there in San Francisco, right across the bay from where labs were testing ways to break down the elderly or the debilitated. This test, the germ warfare, was dangerous to the elderly and debilitated, and those are the people that Hitler and the Nazis didn't like. The U.S. Army facility at Fort Detrick, Maryland, today still makes diseases to pass around. That was in 1984, a year and a half ago. And Advanced Genetic Sciences opened up their offices in Oakland, California, in the same city, not coincidentally, in 1969. Now, the story is that they started labs in 1950 to 1970, but in 1969, maybe they closed the lab there in Oakland, but AGS opened up in Oakland, and they opened with Mr. Diot and Mr. Adams. Diot came out from Princeton University, and Mr. Adams opened it up. He was the member of the all the offices of Sullivan and Cromwell that I cited last week, and he came to a place known as Oakland, California, where they would be put $20 million into experimenting with putting live genetically altered bacteria into strawberries and potatoes, not to see the frost. They admit now it's not the frost, it's that it travels. How far will these genetically altered bacteria with one gene removed travel? So in 1970, if that office was closed, in 1969, AGS was set up. First they tested animals and then germ warfare. They admitted it was dangerous to these various people, that they were still making these diseases. And the article went on to say they made viruses, mysterious organisms, infections that would affect human beings, and they can lie dormant for many years, progressively and relentlessly destroying brain and nervous tissue. And I think of the preponderance of Alzheimer's disease and the brain disease AIDS affects the brain. That's one of the big factors that it does affect, is the brains. And I cited in 1984, the Alzheimer, the swine flu, the Legionnaires, the disease progeria, that I believe is a man-made disease for people that turn old ahead of their time, young people. And I cited Tay-Sachs and AIDS and sickle cell and some of these diseases that affect the young, the blacks, and so forth. We'll take a one-minute break. As I say, in July of 84, I was talking about AIDS and these mysterious organisms, and talking about a laboratory that opened up in Oakland that was allegedly supposed to be closed in 1970, and now in 1985, we have learned, 1986 rather, that AGS opened up in 1969 in the same city of Oakland and is working on altered genetics and bacteria that could affect the immune system. I say, well, said before, we'll really do it now. We'll take a one-minute break and continue with some news stories that I cited in part of the overview, but want to get into detail as much as time allows for the rest of this program.